I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. George Mitchell has some advice for you if you want to be a negotiator. Speak less and listen more. Be patient and have perseverance. Be willing to take a risk. Learn how to compromise. Mitchell learned these firsthand crafting the Good Friday Agreement in 1998 that brought about the end of violence in Northern Ireland. He was President Obama's special envoy to the Arab-Israeli peace negotiations, unable, like many others, to resolve that long-standing conflict. His new book is The Negotiator: Reflections on an American Life. He grew up in a poor and proud family in Maine, served as federal judge, was Democratic U.S. Senator from 1980 to 1995, the last 4 years as majority leader. He authored the Mitchell Report about the use of performance-enhancing drugs in Major League Baseball. More recently, he was a monitor for Penn State University after this Sandusky child sex abuse scandal. He joins us on Radio Times to share his personal story and some of the lessons that he has learned in his varied career. And George Mitchell, great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Any signs as a kid that you were going to grow up to be a good negotiator?
None whatsoever.
None whatsoever.
I was scrawny. Somewhat behind my peers, so much so that my mother insisted that I start drinking goat's milk, which I did as a kid. And so in my family, we have a large and close family, it's become a running joke. A good score in the test, it's the goat's milk. Got elected to the Senate, the goat's milk.
It sounds like you came from an athletic family and that your brothers were athletes. I guess you were the brother trying to keep up with them.
That's right.
To sort of show yourself on the basketball court.
That's right. I have three older brothers. They're all great athletes. They all went to college on sports scholarships. I came along, and not only was I not as good as my brothers, I was not as good as anyone else's brother.
Really? That bad?
Well, I played in high school and actually more in college and a great deal more in the Army, but I really wasn't up to my brother's standards, so much so that when I was a kid, I became known around our small town in Maine as Johnny Mitchell's kid brother, the one who isn't any good. So I developed both an inferiority complex and a highly competitive attitude toward my brothers.
Indeed, and I have to say that was one of my takeaways from your book. You grew up in a really interesting family in that your mother was an immigrant from Lebanon. Your father was actually an orphan. I guess his family from Ireland. He was raised in an orphanage, adopted at the age of 4. You were poor, but clearly a proud family as well.
We were poor, but we didn't know it because we lived the way everyone else lived that we knew. We grew up in what would now be considered a slum along the banks of a heavily polluted river directly adjacent to a large textile mill. The textile mills were booming in New England then, and immigrants came pouring in by the thousands to go to work in the mills. My mother was one of them. My mother spent nearly 50 years working the night shift in a textile mill.
Wow.
Most of the immigrants were French-Canadian from Quebec, but there were large numbers of others, and a small Lebanese colony of immigrants developed in our community, mostly Lebanese Christians fleeing strife back in their home country. What's going on now in the Middle East is not new in history. It's been going on for a very long time. And so while we were poor and the area was a bunch of tenements jammed up against each other, everybody lived the same way, so nobody knew it. And very early in life, we developed from our parents a very strong work ethic. I worked since I was a little kid at several jobs all the time.
And your four siblings, their five children, your parents' five children, all graduated from college.
We did. My mother was a textile mill worker. My father was a laborer and later a janitor. They didn't have any money. My parents didn't own a car for most of our lives. But they had a dream. And the dream was that their kids would go to college.
Mm.
And what happened was all five did graduate from college. Two of us have graduate degrees. And we have lived lives that, to all of us, that simply would have been unimaginable for my parents.
Your parents, obviously, who were immigrants to this country, you really credit your mother. In fact, you say she was the most, perhaps even to this day, the most influential person in your life.
She was. She was a very strong and determined woman. She wasn't educated. She couldn't read or write English. She spoke with a thick and heavy accent, but she was a very dominating figure in our lives, full of love and a lot of laughter. I said in the book that I didn't think about it that way when I was a kid, but she was really fun to be around. For example, we followed baseball. We were all sports fanatics. And we living in New England, we were all Red Sox fans. And
of Ted, course, Ted you Williams, have to be, right?
Ted Williams was a hero. So we listened to the games. My mother knew nothing about baseball, didn't understand it at all. But because we followed it, she followed it. And she liked to talk back to the radio announcer when he was announcing a game. She'd comment on his comments. And when Ted Williams hit a homer, she'd lead the cheers.
Oh, that's great. I have to say, and I appreciated so much learning about your family, is that your father spent about a decade of his working life unemployed. And it seemed to affect it. I mean, Why wouldn't it? But he was really, sounds like, depressed.
It was about
angry.
A year.
About a year.
It was about a year. It was my senior year in high school. He had left school at the age of 10 and worked for 40 years nonstop, mostly as a laborer. And when he was 50, in my senior in high school, he was out of work. It had a devastating effect on him and on our family. Very nearly destroyed him. It was by far the worst year of my life. He became increasingly depressed, increasingly withdrew within himself, embarrassed and ashamed, lost his sense of self-esteem. He tried very hard to get a job, couldn't get one. Finally, after a year of agony, he got a job as a janitor at a local college. And honestly, you'd think he'd become president of the college.
Wow.
He was so proud of having a job again. And that's been with me all of my life. I know that in every society there are deadbeats and people who game the system, but the overwhelming majority of people who are out of work desperately want to work because they know that in our society self-esteem comes with doing something meaningful in and with your life. I think sometimes some in our society are excessively generalized when they criticize the unemployed and those not doing as well.
You describe, I mean, as you said, this was a very difficult period in his life, in the family's life. I mean, it sounds like you and he kind of were on the outs during this period.
We did. We had a bad time. My older brothers were by then all away in college, so it was just my younger sister and myself. I was young, insecure myself, naive. I didn't fully comprehend, as I do now, what my father was going through.
Yeah.
And frankly, I was ashamed of him. And he was ashamed of himself. So it was a downward cycle of despair. And we didn't get along. We clashed often. And then there was mostly silence at the end until he got a job.
And then, I mean, were you able to sort of make up with your dad?
Oh, after that, yeah, it was wonderful. He got a job. He was very proud of it. He was a janitor, but he did a good job at it. And he used to laugh and joke. I went to Bowdoin College, which is about 50 miles from our hometown. And he was a janitor at Colby College, both small liberal arts schools, very good schools in Maine. And after I graduated from Bowdoin, I was scheduled to go into the Army, in the Army ROTC program as an officer in the U.S. Army. But I was subject to call-up, so I went back to my home. And, of course, I couldn't get a permanent job because I could be called up at any time. So my father got me a job on the grounds crew at Colby. And I'd mow the lawns and paint the window panes. And my father's great delight in life, when some passerby or anybody he knew came by, he'd say, "See that boy over there? He just graduated from Bowdoin." He said, "Colby has reached such a stage of excellence that you need a Bowdoin degree to get a job on the grounds crew here." And he'd laugh uproariously. So after he got back to work, we reconciled, and it was wonderful really to see him again, laughing, smiling, standing straight, over the tough time.
I mean, it sounds like that made a huge impression on you.
It did. Very, very deep and profound.
Did you think you were going to – I mean, it sounds like looking at your career, you thought you were going to do one thing and then you ended up doing something else. Did you imagine yourself having a military career, for instance?
I didn't when I took ROTC in college. I frankly did it for the money. We were paid for training, and I needed the money. I worked at several jobs while going through college. My parents couldn't provide any money for tuition. But then when I get into the Army, I loved it. I spent 2 years, just under 2 years, in Berlin, Germany, in U.S. military intelligence. I feel the greatest period of my life was when I was in college and then in the Army. I really learned in the Army discipline, reinforced the values of patriotism, organization, working with others. And I tried to reenlist. But what happened in the meantime, I'd applied to law school, and the law school granted a one-year extension. The Army insisted on a minimum two-year extension. So I had to choose, and I chose to leave and go to law school. But I think those who don't serve in the military miss something great in life, particularly in this wonderful, free, and open country of ours.
Ed Muskie, former senator from Maine, was another big influence on you as, a young man looking at politics?
Well, I wasn't really looking at politics. I had no interest in it. I graduated from law school. I couldn't get a job with a law firm in Maine.
Why is that?
Well, I'd gone to night school, and I think there was then a little bit of stigma. I worked all during the day and went to school in the evening. Secondly, times were tough when I got out. So I took a job with the Justice Department. I lucked into what they call an honors program. I'd done well in law school at Georgetown. And I spent a couple of years there. And then I got a call one day from a man in Senator Muskie's office. He had a vacancy on his staff. He wanted someone with a legal background. He knew my brothers, knew of my brothers, didn't know me. So I went up, interviewed. And I was very frank to say when he offered me a job, I really don't have any interest in politics. I really want to get back to Maine and practice law. He said, well, if you'll commit to stay with me through the next election, which is about 3 years, I said I would do so. And during that time, I ended up finding a job with a law firm. Mm-hmm. And so I left him after the next election. But by then, I'd kind of gotten the political bug. And so I get into politics that way through him.
And we're almost up on a break here. So infected by this bug of politics, in what way?
I liked it. he was an impressive, tremendously impressive man, large, intelligent, very good speaker. And when I traveled around the state with him, I was like the driver, gopher, aide. It just seemed interesting and enjoyable, and so I thought that's something I'd like to do. And besides that, I could surpass my brothers.
It's always about the brothers
that's right.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Our guest is George Mitchell. He's written a memoir. It's called The Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life. He grew up in Maine. He served in the U.S. Senate. He helped to negotiate the peace accord in Northern Ireland. He's had a very busy career, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with a former senator from Maine, George Mitchell, author of a new book called The Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life. You did at one point in your life run for the governor of Maine. You did not win this, but I appreciated your honesty. One of the things that you write in your book is you were not prepared for the intensity of the post-election commentary, in which I was described as too stiff, too lawyerly, lacking in appeal and charisma. I read and listened to so much of this analysis that I eventually accepted it as true.
I did, and that's why later, when I was a federal judge and the governor called me and asked if he could appoint me to the U.S. Senate to complete Senator Muskie's term, I wavered. I wasn't sure because I felt insecure about the possibility of ever winning an election. And of course, as you know, federal judges are appointed for life.
Right.
And in fact, my brothers urged me not to accept the offer, to stay where I was. My brother Johnny said to me, well, you're a born loser, he said. You couldn't possibly win a statewide election, so you better stay where you are. So I then, after listening to that for about 15 minutes from my brothers, I called the governor. I said, Governor, I accept.
Of course. And then, eventually, obviously, you won the Senate seat. And how did your brothers react to that?
Oh, they were great. We have very close families, competitive but loving. We still see each other often. I go back home as much as I can to see them, and we have a wonderful relationship.
You have just a hilarious section, and it sounds like this was literally your first day on the job as a senator from Maine, and there was a filibuster going on. Perhaps I'll have you describe it to our listeners.
There was a filibuster, and I, not knowing any better, went to the Senate floor, where I discovered, to my surprise, nobody else was there. Finally, a senator came in and talked for about 6 hours, and since I was the only other person in the chamber, he spoke to me. And then another one came in. I stayed there that whole time, determined to be a real senator and do the nation's business. But, of course, I was the only one there the whole time, except for the guy who was speaking. And finally, I was tired, exhausted. And I went over to an aide standing by the Senate chamber, and I said, excuse me, I'm new here. He said, Senator, that's obvious to everyone. I said, where are these other senators? I'm out here tending to the nation's business all night long, and what do they do? Where do they go? He said, well, I'll show you. And he took me around to a large room just outside the Senate floor. It's like an anteroom, a waiting room, and then it's kind of a library nearby. And there were, to my astonishment, a whole bunch of narrow canvas folding cots set up, the type you see in emergency shelters. And I had to clamber over other senators to get to an empty cot. Finally, I laid down, and I really thought I'd made a mistake. I thought, oh, here I was, a very dignified person wearing a black robe. People stood up on the end of the room and sat down when I sat down. And now I was sitting there with a bunch of old guys snoring away in this anteroom. And just as I was wallowing in self-pity, I rolled over, and in the next cot, I looked into the face of Senator John Warner of Virginia, the wonderful guy. We became good friends. And I thought to myself, now he was at that time married to Elizabeth Taylor.
Right.
So I thought, who am I to feel sorry for myself? Here's a guy who could be home legally in bed with Elizabeth Taylor and he's spending the night with me. And it really did. I thought to myself, I got to get out of this self-pity and get to start work and do things. And so it served as a good, both as a good story and as a good incentive for me.
It's a great story. You also say, just of climbing over these bodies, the first was Ted Kennedy. He was a big man at that moment. He looked to me like Mount Everest.
Yes, Teddy was a good friend, too. Well, you remember, Teddy was a big guy.
He was. He became quite a big guy.
Yeah, and I had to climb over him. And what I say when I tell the story is I had to use all the athletic skill my brothers insist I don't have to climb over Teddy without waking him up.
And you were able, obviously, to accomplish that. This was, though, a time when there was real comity, I guess, in the U.S. Senate. Bob Dole, I guess, was your counterpart for many of the years in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
You were able to work with him, and it seems like that's almost impossible these days. What changed?
When I was elected Senate Majority Leader, one of the first persons I called was Bob Dole, who was then the Republican leader in the Senate, and I went to see him. I said to him that I've been here very long, you've been here decades, and you know a lot more about the Senate than I do, but I've seen enough to know that these jobs as leaders of the Senate are very difficult, and if we don't have any trust between us, they'll be darn near impossible. So I said, I've come here to tell you how I intend to behave towards you and ask you to reciprocate. And I set forth really just the most basic standards of fairness and decency and courtesy. He was delighted.
Was this something new?
Well,
for him, you think?
I think his relations with our predecessor were rocky at times. So we shook hands, and to this moment, literally to this moment, never has a harsh word passed between Bob Dole and I in public or private. We became very good friends. We still are good friends. We speak occasionally on the phone. I recently telephoned him. It was his birthday. I think it was his 90th.
Mm-hmm.
And he still physically is having a tough time, but he's still sharp as a tack. And we disagreed on almost every issue that came before the Senate. We negotiated endlessly over procedures in the Senate and legislative language, but it was never rancor, it was never personal, it was never harsh. I think there have been a lot of changes, although I have to say it was tough then. We had some very tough direct debates and discussions, strong disagreements. I thought it was hard, but it was nothing like compared to what it is now.
I mean, obviously the goal is some kind of compromise, but that's become a bad word for some people in Congress.
To some.
Not all, but to some.
But that's a mistaken view, and it accounts for some of the intense partisanship now because, particularly in the House of Representatives, the pivotal moment in the election process is no longer the general election. It's the primary or the nominating process, because gerrymandering has reached such a high state of precision that right now any expert can tell you who will win in about 75 or 80% of the seats next year in the House, not which person but which party. So for the guys, men and women, running for the House, it's the getting nominated that decides the election, not the general election. And as you know, we have a very poor record in this country of election participation, even in presidential elections. In the off year, it's very small.
Yes.
So that gives disproportionate weight to the more extreme elements in both parties. They tend to be more rigid, more ideological, more unwilling to compromise. I watched on television a couple of years ago as a Tea Party member of the House of Representatives stood up and said, compromise is wrong. It's what got us to these problems. I'm against any form of compromise. One commentator said, well, you know, that's ridiculous. This is a country of 300 million people, very diverse. You can't govern without ever compromising. He said, I'll bet 9 out of 10 people disagree with him. And the other commentator said, yeah, but he's talking to the one.
Right.
The one person who will participate in his nomination. You combine that with the money, the extremely excessive and corrupting amounts of money now that go into our political process, and I think you have a deadly combination that leads to what – there may well be other factors. I'm not a professional political scientist. Only time will tell. But I know those are contributing factors.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's George Mitchell, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's had a busy career, a busy life. He's also written a book called The Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life. It's in part about growing up in Maine, also about some of his time in the U.S. Senate and his work in Northern Ireland to bring about a peace there. Also, the struggles trying to do the same thing in the Middle East. And we are taking comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. We'll open up the phones a little bit later on in the hour. I do want to play a clip, and this is goes back to the Iran-Contra hearings. And this is a clip of you talking to Oliver North. And for those people that weren't around or don't remember what Iran-Contra was all about, this was during the Reagan administration. Members of the Reagan administration were secretly working up or trying to sell arms to Iran with the thought that they could get some release of hostage and also send some of the money to the Contras who were fighting in Central America. And this is from July 13th, 1987, during the Iran-Contra hearings, Oliver North's last day testifying. And this is you talking. Let's give it a listen, and then I'll talk to you about it.
Of all the qualities which the American people find compelling about you, none is more impressive than your obvious deep devotion to this country. Please remember that others share that devotion. And recognize that it is possible for an American to disagree with you on aid to the Contras and still love God and still love this country just as much as you do. Although he's regularly asked to do so, God does not take sides in American politics. And in America, disagreement with the policies of the government is not evidence of lack of patriotism. I want to repeat that. in America, disagreement with the policies of the government is not evidence of lack of patriotism. Indeed, it's the very fact that Americans can criticize their government openly and without fear of reprisal that is the essence of our freedom and that will keep us free. Now, I have one final plea. Debate this issue forcefully and vigorously, as you have and as you surely will. But please, do it in a way that respects the patriotism and the motives of those who disagree with you, as you would have them respect yours.
Why did you say that to Oliver North?
Oliver North was a very charismatic leader. A very effective advocate for himself and his cause in his prior testimony to the committee. And during that time, he had said to one of the members of the committee, if you love God, if you love our country, then you should vote for aid to the Contras. At that time, wisely or not, it was against the law to provide aid to the Contras. And secondly, what he said was to me obviously not consistent with American principles and ideals, that somehow God supported voting for aid to the Contras and those who didn't vote for that aid didn't believe in or love God. I mean, it was just so inconsistent with our ideals. So I talked with a lawyer from Portland, Maine, a very close friend of mine, Harold Patius, very wise guy, wise meaning knowledgeable and intelligent. And he said to me, you really got to take that on. He said, that's just so inconsistent with our principles. So that's what motivated me. And the day before that hearing, I sat down in my office. It was a Sunday. And I wrote out that statement and made it. And I don't think I dented North's popularity very much. He was extremely popular. But I got across a contrary point of view, one that has stood the test of time. And I just ask you and the listeners to consider what the uproar in America would be today if President Obama sold missiles to Iran.
Well, I'm glad you said that because, yeah. I mean, I very clearly remember the Iran-Contra hearings. Fast forward to today, yeah, when we're trying to negotiate this nuclear deal with Iran, and the thought that a member of an administration was secretly trying to sell arms to Iran in the 1980s.
Did sell arms to Iran.
Did sell, sorry,
the administration,
yes,
did so. And this was just a few years after the Iranian hostage taking, which occurred, of course, in President Carter's administration. The hostages were released by Iran on the day of President Reagan's inaugural. So it was very controversial. In retrospect, obviously, it was a mistake to sell arms to missiles, especially to Iran. But the important thing was that political advocates throughout all of human history, and certainly in the world today, seek to justify their policies on the grounds that God is on their side. We're doing it in the name of God. We are committing the most evil actions. We are perpetrating atrocities because we do it for God. And I think it's something that is always a danger in human society. And in the United States, we have tried with some degree of reasonable success to separate church and state and let policy stand on their own merits. They're earth-based, they're people-based, they're ground-based. They don't have anything to do with God. And I think we have to make that point over and over again in our history.
Well, even listening to that, I listened to it several times. I was wondering whether, you know, this is a sign of George Mitchell as negotiator, because up front you praise him for his patriotism, you praise Oliver North for his devotion to God, but then you sort of very carefully kind of pivot into really what you wanted to say to him.
Well, one of the problems in political life, really in all of human life, is distinguishing the argument from the person making the argument. Now, it's human nature. Someone we don't like makes an argument. We tend not to give it the attention it gets if it's someone we do like. Mm-hmm. And when we're opposed to someone, we don't really listen to their arguments because we assume they're going to be wrong. In fact, I learned often to my great, and I think often surprise, people who I didn't care for, people who I didn't agree with, have a lot of good ideas. And sometimes they're better ideas than I have. And you have to work hard to suppress the natural human tendency to dismiss, to be intolerant of arguments that are contrary to your own views and arguments that are made by those whom you don't like, and especially when those two combine.
Indeed. Would you say you learned some of your negotiating skills then with your years in the U.S. Senate?
Yes. I think much of what I learned – well, first, I have no formal training in negotiating or advocacy. It's all trial and error through experience, and much of it came in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And I put that to good use in Northern Ireland. Also in the Middle East, although we didn't get the result we wanted, no one has been able to get it in the Middle East. I think it will in time come, and that is genuinely listen to people and block out from your mind that you disagreed with him yesterday. Block out from your mind that you don't care for him. Block out your mind that he did something you don't think about. Focus on the argument he's making. Does it make sense? Will it help to solve the problem? Will it move the process forward? Tough to do. But with discipline and focus, you can do it that way.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with George Mitchell in this hour of Radio Times. He's written a new book. It's a memoir. It's called The Negotiator, subtitled Reflections on an American Life, from Maine to the U.S. Senate, from baseball to Disney, from Northern Ireland to the Middle East. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page as well. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And again, I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with George Mitchell about his memoir called The Negotiator. It's about his life growing up in Maine, his years in the U.S. Senate, what he has learned from his career, in particular, negotiating the peace in Northern Ireland and his efforts to try to do the same in the Middle East. Why do you think you were able, along with others, to come to some kind of a peace accord in Northern Ireland?
There are a number of factors. The first was, I think, a general weariness with war and conflict. It's very difficult in these divided societies. People killed, people horribly maimed. Fear and anxiety, a constant factor in life. I think people had gotten tired of it. I think the real heroes are the political leaders of Northern Ireland, ordinary men and women who had spent their lives in conflict but who had the courage to make these difficult decisions in a very dangerous period, dangerous for them personally and for their families. The Middle East is more complicated, more difficult, several intersecting, overlapping, sometimes contradictory conflicts in the Middle East. You didn't have an external presence like Iran is in the Middle East now. So it's tougher, but I think in the end, both Israelis and Palestinians will recognize that it's in their self-interest to establish a two-state, to reach an agreement on a two-state solution. And I think that will happen. Mm.
And I do want to get to that, but I do want to play again. This is you making some closing remarks as negotiations successfully conclude on the Good Friday Agreement, and this is April 10th, 1998.
This agreement is good for the people of Ireland, North and South. It was made possible by the leadership, the commitment, and in these last few days, the personal negotiating skill of Prime Minister Tony Blair and the Taoiseach, Bertie Ahern. Their commitment has been evident by their presence here for days, their hands-on style, their all-night effort.
And again, our guest, George Mitchell, talking about the successful conclusion of the Good Friday Agreement, April 10th, 1998. You also do describe, one of these horrible terrorist attacks. It was in Omaha. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly or not. Yes. Where 29 people were killed, 300 people were injured. How much do you think that horrific event helped to bring about this agreement?
Well, the event occurred after the agreement.
That
was the particular tragedy of it. We reached the agreement in April. It was approved in a referendum in May. And then that summer, there were two horrific incidents just prior to the Omaha bombing. Two young boys were burned to death as they slept in bed. Someone threw a firebomb into their bedroom. And then Omaha happened, and I went to Omaha at the request of President Clinton to meet with survivors, and I do describe that in the book. What the result of that was, though, to pull the country together more. The murderers who committed the horrific crimes at Omaha hoped to spark a resumption of sectarian violence. They wanted to reignite the war. Much terrorism has to do with that objective. But the leaders of Northern Ireland, Protestant who are unionists, Catholics who tend to be nationalists, came together, and the public rejected a return to violence. So in a sense, it backfired, but at a horrible cost of, as you said, 29 killed and about 330 badly injured.
Picking up on what you said about the Middle East, and I mean, every conflict obviously is different. There's deep history here. There are deep hurts here as well. Do you think it is the job of the United States to try to play broker in this agreement?
It is in the interest of the United States to try to bring about an agreement. Our national security interests, I think, would be enhanced by an agreement that would enable Israel to exist behind secure and defensible borders. Hopefully, it would lead to the normalization of relations between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Even though now they have very common interests in many respects, they don't act on them because of this barrier that exists because of the Palestinian issue. Take the item number one of the day, Iran. Israel is adamantly opposed to Iran's getting a nuclear weapon. So is Saudi Arabia. So are most of the other Gulf countries. And yet their efforts are not coordinated in any way because they can't talk because of this Palestinian issue. That's just one small example, and I think you'd see that ripple effect throughout the region. And so I do think ultimately it will happen.
But how much does it require people who truly want to resolve a conflict, knowing, of course, how complicated it is?
One of the major factors in all these conflicts is the absence of trust. In the Middle East, it's not just the absence of trust, it's a high level of active mistrust. I say in the book that Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas don't trust or like each other. That's a contributing factor. It's not the only factor. There are many others among the people. But President George W. Bush went to Jerusalem a week before he left office. On January 9th, I think probably 11 days before, he gave a speech in Jerusalem, which I thought set out very persuasively that the interests of Israelis and Palestinians is in both getting what they want because neither can achieve its objective by denying to the other what it wants. The Israelis have a very, very effective state. They don't have security. They live in constant fear and anxiety. The Palestinians don't have a state and they want one. But the Palestinians aren't going to get a state until the people of Israel have reasonable and sustainable security. They're not going to get that security until the Palestinians get a state. So they're vested not only in their interests but in the others' interests as well. And President Bush made that case very well. I urge anyone interested in that subject to take a look at that speech. And it still holds true today.
I mean, would it be fair to say that everyone knows what the final goal probably will be? They just don't know how to get there?
They not only know the goal, they know the approximation of the outcome, been set out many times. President Clinton set it out when he left office in a major speech that he gave just before leaving office, what are now called the Clinton parameters. And it won't be exactly that. They'll be adjusted and modified to take into account subsequent events. But they know how it's going to end. It's getting there. That's the problem, because both societies are deeply divided. But remember, about half the Palestinians support Hamas, which doesn't recognize Israel. About, and I don't know the numbers in Israel, but many members of the government now take the position there can never be a Palestinian state on the West Bank. Mm. So no political leader is going to take a huge risk by making concessions, subject himself to criticism if he doesn't think it's going to work. And right now they don't think it's going to work, so they refrain from taking the steps needed to get an agreement.
In your book, you talk about, from your own experience, and these are probably things we could apply to all of our lives in terms of negotiation. As you say, speak less, listen more. And as you say, listening is sometimes a really hard thing to do. Be patient, have perseverance, be willing to take a risk, and also learn how to compromise. Right. I mean, are those the sort of things to live by?
Yes, but underlying all of that, of course, is sound judgment. Taking a risk one day may be foolhardy. Taking it the next day may make sense. You have to have human judgment, and that requires not only knowledge of the specifics of what you're dealing with, but a certain degree of what we call wisdom, that is good judgment based on, you know, a lifetime of experience.
I was reading, this goes back to the Ireland negotiations, is that at some point you took everyone and sort of just put them all together, made sure that they all sat around in a room, that they walked together, that they talked together, and sort of, I guess, getting beyond the kind of impasse and try to get to relationship, sort of like you did with Bob Dole.
Yes, to try to create trust among individuals. Right. That's exactly right. When I first went there, they didn't talk to each other. They wouldn't listen to each other. It was two separate camps, which never the twain shall meet.
Yeah.
And I tried to get them together on human terms. In fact, when we met, we had a dinner jointly on the occasions you describe. I insisted that they not all sit on one end and only talk over there. They mix it up. And I said to them, no talk at this table about the issues.
Huh?
Talk about, they said, what are we going to talk about? I said, your wives, your kids, your dogs, your vacations, your hobbies, sports, anything but the issues. Because I wanted them to learn to see the other side as human beings, just like themselves, who disagreed on an issue, but also wanted the same things, peace, stability, prosperity, a good life for their kids.
We have a comment. I'm reading here about the Iran negotiations. Now, you're not privy to them necessarily, but do you think there's something that could or should be done to find some kind of resolution?
I think the president is on the right course in negotiating. The reality is that Iran cannot be permitted to have a nuclear weapon. It would not only be a direct threat to Israel, it would be destabilizing of the entire nuclear nonproliferation regime. There are two ways to get there, through negotiation or through war. It's common sense to try to negotiate a verifiable agreement that would achieve that result and not go to war right away. And so I think the president's trying to do that. I think the interim agreement was much better than even the critics had hoped for. Many of them criticized it. Their criticisms have proven to be false or misleading. The question now is the agreement verifiable? And here's the issue. The Ayatollah and the president of Iran have said repeatedly Iran doesn't want a nuclear weapon. But the actions of their government contradict their words, actions verified by the International Atomic Energy Agency. So an agreement based on trust is out of the question. Mm. They will agree, in order to get rid of these onerous sanctions, to take certain steps. But doing what you agree to do is different from agreeing to it. And we have to have a mechanism for verifying that they will do what they say they're going to do, and if they don't, that the sanctions will remain in effect or be reimposed. So to me, the crucial element of the final agreement will be the processes for verification that are included in it. The president's opponents say, walk away, increase the sanctions, and Iran will come crawling back. That's completely unrealistic for one basic reason. It's not just U.S. and Iran. This is the U.S., China, Russia, Britain, France, and Germany on one side of the table. The sanctions are effective precisely because they are universal, not just U.S. sanctions. If we walk away, it is virtually certain, in the case of China and Russia, already certain, and probably the others as well, that they won't agree to increase or even extend the sanctions. So the sanctions will go from universal to unilateral, from effective to ineffective. And we will be left with two choices, a nuclear-armed Iran or a war to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran. The negotiation to achieve it makes much more sense. And I think the president and the secretary have done the right thing in proceeding, but we have to wait and see what the verification procedures are, what it is that will enable us, the other five countries and the rest of the world, to be confident that Iran will do what it says it will do in the agreement.
Do you wish you were there, part of the negotiating team?
Well, I've had my time there. I have great confidence in the president and the secretary of state.
Fair enough. Let me see what Jim from media has to say. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was curious as to what Senator Mitchell thought of the manner in which both he and the peace process were depicted in the novel Transatlantic.
Oh, I don't know that novel. Do you know that novel?
It's a wonderful book written by a great Irish-American author, Colin McCann. He writes historical novels that take facts and actual persons and then weaves a story around them. Colm is a very good friend. He's a great writer. I'm sort of an amateur. He introduced me at an event in New York last week, and I said I feel like a little leaguer being introduced by Babe Ruth at a baseball event. But I enjoyed the book. The parts about my actual work in Northern Ireland are fiction. They're part of the tale that he weaves, although the general setting and the background and the depictions of me and my family are accurate.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Speaking of baseball, your report on the use of performance-enhancing drugs in Major League Baseball, did you get the response that you hoped your report would get?
Initially, no. The players and the Players Association were adamantly opposed to my investigation, refused to talk to me. But since then, since the report was issued and changes have been made, there has been a dramatic and a very positive transformation in the attitudes of the players. I think they now accept the reality that the principal victims of those who cheat are the players who don't cheat, and that they ought now really, including the Players Association, support a strong and effective program. So I think it's turned out well, although at the time it was very difficult.
Almost out of time here. Would your first grade teacher have thought that you would end up doing all the things that you have done in your life?
I doubt it. I think my first grade teachers would be more surprised than anyone at the outcome.
Were you a kind of a touch-and-go student?
Well, I did okay. I didn't work too hard. I read comic books and played sports and fooled around and didn't have much discipline or motivation, but that came later in life.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. George Mitchell, our guest, and his new book is called The Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life from Maine to the U.S. Senate, from baseball to Disney, from Northern Ireland to the Middle East. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter, how to listen to us on satellite radio. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.